almost a $2 million fine for over 200 million gallons of spilled sewage in Fort Lauderdale. Should there be an earlier last call on Ocean Drive for spring break? And is Broward County ready for presidential primary voters? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Fort Lauderdale has about 6 weeks to pay an almost $2 million fine for the sewage spills over the past 2 months. Tens of millions of gallons of sewage has poured into canals and onto streets. The state calls it the worst string of sewage spills in Florida history. Next week, Miami Beach City Commissioners will decide whether or not to end alcohol sales earlier than usual on South Beach during spring break. Will it mean a quieter time on the beach? Will it cost the beach business? And the presidential primary is about 3 weeks away. Is Broward County ready to count its ballots? It's all ahead on the South Florida Roundup, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Pipes in Fort Lauderdale keep breaking. That's been almost a daily, weekly reality for a lot of people living and working in the city. On Monday, another water pipe broke on East Broward Boulevard. More than 200 million gallons of sewage have spilled from busted pipes in Fort Lauderdale since December. And the state responded to the sewer spills this week. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection fined the city $1.8 million. That amount is based in part on how much sewage has spilled. This is first up this week here on the South Florida Roundup. Rob Hernandez is along with us, the deputy city manager for the city of Fort Lauderdale. He's with us over the telephone. And in studio is WLRN's Broward County reporter, Katie Swatowski. Rob, let me start with you. What's the city's response to this $1.8 million fine that was levied this week by the Florida DEP?
Well, Tom, we are certainly disappointed by the state's reaction to the crisis that we've been dealing with here for the last couple of weeks. Certainly imposing a fine is not something that we think is productive, and certainly won't help us get over the finish line in terms of resolving all these issues. But we understand that the state was in a position where they had to do something. Again, we're disappointed by their action, but we've been encouraged by the conversations that we've had with various state representatives over the last 2 days or so. And we think that we'll be working on some sort of an agreement or arrangement that is satisfactory both to them and to us.
An agreement or arrangement, would that preclude or drop the fine entirely against the city?
Well, we're looking at the fine as punitive in nature, and this is certainly not some. The events that have happened over the last couple of weeks are not the result of the inaction of any current staff member, or certainly as a result of the inaction of the city commission. And so, we're not looking for something that is punitive in nature to the city, and we're hoping that we can work out an arrangement with the state that will allow us to use those dollars to either restore the quality of our waterways that were impacted by the sewage spills, or that they will allow us to put that money back into some other project that will help prevent something like this from happening again, because a punitive fine isn't going to help anybody.
And Mr. Hernandez, it's Katie Swatowski. I know that Fort Lauderdale was under a consent order for a spill that happened in 2016, and the city was able to work out using part of the fine to pay for some of the things in the consent order to fix. Is there a similar arrangement? I know the mayor, Dean Trantalis, also said he was hoping that this fine could be in part put towards some of the repairs the city's looking at.
And that's exactly what we're trying to work out with the state. As you mentioned, we do have that arrangement with the state as part of the previous consent decree, that required the city of Fort Lauderdale to undertake $200 million or so in wastewater-related projects, which we've done and which we are ahead of schedule on. And so we're looking to do a similar arrangement such that those dollars would go back to fund another project or to clean up the quality of the waterways that were impacted.
And
so there is certainly precedence there.
Precedence, but is there the possibility of that? In other words, how is that being greeted at the Department of Environmental Protection? Is there an interest in doing that the second time around?
Well, I can tell you that as we speak, the city manager, Chris Lagerblum, has been in Tallahassee, and he's been there, you know, since yesterday, and has concluded a series of very productive conversations with a variety of state agencies, and to include the governor's office. And I think that he's flying back from Tallahassee later on today, very optimistic that we'll be able to work out something that is different from a punitive fine.
Well, in the State Department of Environmental Protection, when they did lay this fine on the city just the other night, their spokesperson included a statement that said they are going to continue to hold local officials accountable for maintaining, monitoring, and repairing critical infrastructure. Does that kind of go against the mayor's plea for extra help from the state and federal government to pay for these repairs?
Well, I can't speak to the state's comment, and certainly I cannot also speak on behalf of the mayor, but I think that what you're hearing is just some sense of desperation in terms of, you know, local government recognizing that the cost and the scope of replacing infrastructure is really significant. And as South Florida communities continue to age, you know, I think that there's a desire for more involvement from the state and federal governments in assisting local governments in dealing with not just wastewater and water quality issues, but also stormwater and sea level rise. So I think that that's what you're hearing. But again, I'm not speaking, you know, as a spokesperson for the mayor.
We're speaking with Rob Hernandez, the deputy city manager for the city of Fort Lauderdale. Katie Switalski, Broward County reporter here at WLRN, also along with us, talking about the state of water infrastructure, essentially, in Fort Lauderdale. Water and sewer pipes, especially sewer pipes, have been bursting over the past couple of months. The state this week levying a $1.8 million fine because of these recent sewage spills. Rob, what are the funding options if the state, or rather, if the city has to pay the state this $1.8 million fine, or any fine for that matter?
Well, if we have to pay the fine, you know, it's either going to have to come out of the water and sewer fund or the city's general fund. And again, we believe that $1.8 million will be, you know, will best serve our local residents and our taxpayers by being reinvested into some of these projects rather than, you know, just going in and being deposited into, you know, a general fund at the state level. Again, we're not being critical of the state. We understand that they were in the position where they felt that they had to take some sort of action. But again, we're hopeful that we'll be able to work something out that is slightly different than just a fine.
When it comes to the punitive nature of the fine, I mean, 1.4 of the $1.8 million is civil penalties based on how much sewage and how many days the sewage spill went on. If that money does have to come out, or at least part of that money has to come out of the general fund or the water and sewer fund, does that change the city's plan to, I know currently the city is in the middle of weaning off of trying to take of taking money out of those funds to balance the regular budget. That was a practice left over from the last city administration. The city's trying to wean off of that right now, but if the city has to pay part of this fine out of those funds again, have you heard from any residents about that? Does that change that practice?
No, we haven't heard from any residents, and certainly I don't think it's going to change the practice. The City Commission has made it abundantly clear that we were going to transition away from transferring funds from the Water Sewer Fund into the General Fund. You know, the City Commission that's currently in office directed the city manager to transition us over a four-year period. They have since directed us to accelerate that transition, and that's something that going into next fiscal year that we're certainly looking at. And if there's an opportunity to return those funds at mid-year this year, that's something that our city manager is looking at. But I don't think that the fine is going to derail us from making progress in in, I guess, using your word, weaning ourselves off of that budget transfer. We're under clear direction that the funds that are generated by the Water and Sewer Fund are going to go back into the necessary improvements that need to be made. And certainly we've been working in that direction for the last couple of years, and we will continue to do so.
Rob,
and I think that, I'm sorry, the point that I want to make, and one of the reasons why we are contesting the punitive nature of the fine with the state is that, this city is well aware that it needed to make investments in its infrastructure and to upgrade the quality of its pipes and replace pipes. And it has, for several years now, been very aggressive in doing those investments. And in this particular case, the sewage spills generated from a pipe that we were well underway to replace. And it's just unfortunate that the pipes, the pipe broke in several instances way before we were able to get the replacement pipe in the ground. So it's not like we didn't have a project ready to go, a project that was not funded. In fact, we had a project that was fully funded.
Rob, you talk about the punitive nature of this fine. As Katie mentioned, it's about $1.4 million of the $1.8 million fine that is the civil penalty. Is that the, are you appealing the entire fine or just the $1.4 million? You're willing to pay $400,000?
Well, I think we're going to appeal the entire fine.
Okay. Let me ask you this, in our final moments. If the city is not required to pay the fine to the state, what good is state enforcement?
Well, I think that, that's certainly a question that you need to ask the state, not me. But I think that we all have the same objective, and that is to ensure that our water and wastewater treatment systems are operating properly and are not in a position where they are failing and causing these spills and certainly spills into our waterways. And so I think that the money serves the public better by being reinvested in either preventing or remediating, such events.
And certainly residents that we've spoken with at WLRN agree with that sentiment, that the money should go towards actual repairs. I think one of the things that we've also heard from residents is, no, it may not be current city staff or leaders that have led up to this, but this was a campaign promise before these new commissioners took office, and certainly was a practice of the last commission, of which, the mayor was a part of and has since, shifted over his focus to infrastructure. But, the city has known about these issues, especially since the 2017 Reese report. If you could sort of talk a little bit about what has specifically been done since the new commission took office.
Sure. And you're absolutely right. The city has known about this since 2017. And the city formed a infrastructure improvement plan based on the recommendations of the Reese report, and in fact, has estimated or has identified over $620 million in infrastructure improvement projects over the next 5 years. So the city and the city commission did not ignore the Reese report. It actually, embraced it, and it's part of our strategy for moving forward. So to that end, we are moving forward with replacing sewer mains and water pipes throughout the entire city. And in fact, we just recently completed installing new water mains in Victoria Park, and there's lots of work happening in that community as well. The $65 million redundant force main, which is the project that was previously funded and identified to install that secondary wastewater transmission line to hopefully alleviate any issues associated with the main line that broke. Well, that project is now underway, and we're also installing a permanent bypass line in Rio Vista, mm-hmm. 36th Street Force Main. And if you go on our website, you'll be able to see there are more than 150 different water, wastewater, and stormwater projects that the city is currently actively engaged in. And so, the point here is that the city of Fort Lauderdale and the city commission has not ignored the need for additional infrastructure improvement projects. It has funded them, and these projects are in, well underway. They're either in planning, design, or under construction.
Rob.
And so I urge everyone to go to the city's website at fortlauderdale.gov and click on the tab that says LauderWorks, and you'll be able to bring up all the information related to all those projects.
And we'll clarify, the Reese report referred to here is the consultant report that kind of looked at that water infrastructure in Fort Lauderdale.
Rob, our comprehensive utility master plan.
We're going to leave it there. Rob Hernandez is the deputy city manager for the city of Fort Lauderdale. Katie Swetalski has been reporting on sewer issues and other issues in Broward County as well. She's with us here in studio. Katie and Rob, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
Still to come, the city of Miami Beach has a plan to limit the time alcohol can be sold in some neighborhoods during spring break. That's coming up next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for listening and supporting public radio. Last call for booze on South Beach. How about 2 a.m. for more than a couple of weeks over spring break? Well, the city is expected to vote, a final vote perhaps, coming up on Wednesday. If passed, it could be in effect for 17 days during peak spring break next month on South Beach. It would begin March 6th if finally approved. Bars and restaurants can currently sell alcohol on Miami Beach until 5 a.m. Proposed change here for this last call on South Beach and narrow strip north. What do you think about this? How could this affect your business if you live on South Beach, travel on South Beach, visit South Beach? How do you deal with the spring break traffic? Is it good for business for booze until 5 a.m.? Or could it be bad for business? 800-743-WLRN. Telephone line here, 800-743-9576. Maybe you're a bit of an old-timer, a veteran of spring break years in Fort Lauderdale. Remember those years? What were those experiences like? 800-743-9576. Now, the mayor of Miami Beach, Dan Gelber, had accepted an invitation to join the program today. Unfortunately, something came up at the last moment and has been unable to make it. But we are joined in studio with Ceci Velasco. She's executive director of the Ocean Drive Association, the group of property and business owners who are working to improve the entertainment district of the Ocean Drive area. And Ceci, you support the 5 a.m. last call, correct?
Well, Tom, thank you first for having me on here. Yes, I support the businesses. Primarily, we want to see safety for the city. One of the reasons that we're opposing any kind of rollback to hours is because it's not focusing on the problem. It's actually a solution looking for a problem. If you look at the data of this phenomenon, which we call spring break, 88% of the instances happen prior to 2 a.m. So we collectively have always wanted to maintain the safety of our staff and our guests.
Does that argue for an even earlier last call then? Maybe a midnight last call?
Maybe we should stop serving from 4 p.m. to 11 p.m. It is instances and calls to service to the police department. The phenomenon is a huge, huge amount of density of people on the beach early in the morning. It really has nothing to do with alcohol sales, whether or not they can sell in a bar or not bar. Because quite frankly, we have South Beach Food Festival right now,
right?
More people than ever.
Sure.
We had Super Bowl, more people than you could possibly imagine. We have Winter Music Conference, Ultra Music Festival, New Year's Eve, Art Deco Weekend. I can go on and on about all these hugely populated festivals. We never have a problem, and there's never a discussion to roll back hours in the entertainment district.
So identify that problem. The identification that you have here is the people on the beach, on the sand, in the early morning hours before dawn?
Well, not before dawn. We have people that start at 11 a.m. So if you
start what at 11 a.m.?
They start coming out for,
okay.
This is the Instagram. Is the Instagrammable moment. This is a spring break. They want to be able to get their picture taken and say, I was on South Beach for spring break.
Yeah.
So suddenly you have a huge amount of people that are driving over that aren't staying in our hotels. And they're quite frankly not coming to the clubs.
Okay.
They're going to the public areas, which is the sand. They start at 11 a.m., 10 a.m. They get toasty, right? They're taking, maybe sneaking in some alcoholic beverages. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're smoking a little pot. I'm not sure what's happening out there on the beach itself, but it's a density. It's an overcapacity of a small portion of the beach, because social media has like ran it rampant and say, everybody who's going on spring break, come out here. And the locals go out there. They're not even college kids, a lot of them. They just want to be part of that.
So your association drive members of Ocean Drive are saying it's the density of the visitors on the sand that's the problem.
And then they try to get off the sand after they've been out there and toasty and dehydrated.
Right. And but this is all happening before the sun goes down.
This is all happening.
The beach closes.
Between 11 and 4 p.m. And then at 4 p.m., they're tired and they want to come off the beach. And then there is an influx of density on the street itself. And then what you have is a lot of locals, people that are coming over because they want to commingle mm-hmm. with all of those people. These are not inside any of our businesses. So the 2 a.m., there's no rationale because, one, the calls to service. And we're not the only people that are saying this. We have residents that are saying this. We even have the police chief that is saying this.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I'm still a little confused about what, if you're saying it's not the bars and restaurants,
nope.
It's not the patrons of the bars and restaurants,
correct.
Even between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m.
Correct.
It is the population on the sand while the sun is up. That's the problem.
And them coming off of the beach.
Okay.
And then there's a huge number of people that when they see all these people that are in a public area, you know, you have some characters that want to come over and be part of it. But you also have some predators that want to come over and, you know, commingle with them and sell, illicit and illegal things. And so you have a huge amount of people on the street. They're inside the bars and the clubs are the safest place to be. They're videoed, they're carded, they're managed. But quite frankly, spring break, that kind of that population of people that come over to experience South Beach, they really don't have the funds to pay for a $20 mojito.
Yeah, that's a different conversation altogether, isn't it?
Well, but they're not inside.
Ceci Velasco outside. Is with us. She is the executive director of the Ocean Drive Association. We're talking about what is expected to be a second reading of a potential ordinance in Miami Beach that would temporarily roll back the last call closing time, or at least alcohol selling time, from 5 a.m. until 2 a.m. in the entertainment district in South Beach for 17 days over peak spring break. 800-743-WLRN. Maybe you're among those that have your feet in the sand during spring break in South Beach. What are your experiences? 800-743-9576. 800-743-9576. So you described this, Ceci, as a solution in search of a problem or misidentifying the problem. So how do you and how do the association Ocean Drive members address the problem if it's the problem is identified as you describe it?
And let me be clear, it's not just the Ocean Drive Association. We have a huge amount of stakeholders that have all come together to with a clear understanding that this is not a solution. This is not a solution, and it's because clearly not the problem. The Florida Restaurant Lodging Association has written to the commission and said, we see it from 50,000 feet. We've seen it in Panama City. We've seen it in Key West. We've seen it in other places. Let's learn from their mistakes, because they are now rolling back their legislation that they had. They have economic impacts, and it really hasn't completely helped
them.
So
what are the possible solutions? I mean, it sounds like you've articulated a problem.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that is unique to this time period and unique to this phenomenon, right? Like I said, we have been able to handle Super Bowl mm-hmm. and yet we have to close down the bars and the clubs at this point. So, and you're creating more of a problem right now. I have in that entertainment district over 80 hotels, over 3,000 rooms fully booked for March. 2 weeks beforehand, you're going to tell everybody that they have to close down. We have staffing issues.
To be clear, they're not closing down. They're not. The ordinance isn't to close down, right? I mean, the ordinance, the language that I've seen is stop selling alcohol at 2 a.m.
Yes, but you go to a bar not to sell Pepsi Cola. So, and you do go on vacation not to get a glass of water. You also don't come in from Europe with your families to sit down and have a late night dinner and say, no, you can't have wine with that dinner. So in effect, quite frankly, you know, even the hotel bars are saying, quite frankly, you know, people here on vacation, they expect to have a drink. They expect the Super Bowl experience, and there's no reason why they can't get that. So the negative is a branding image. You're going to have all of these people that have already booked their flights, already booked their 300 $50 a night hotel rooms expecting the Super Bowl experience are not going to get it. So they're going to write about it. So this is going to impact the economy, the tourism economy. We're looking at having, and the hotels are leading this charge, right? I have the Hotel Association,
yeah,
the Chamber of
Commerce.
So
what are the solutions you'd rather have, the commissioners?
There are a lot of solutions.
Consider.
The commission last year in April passed high impact measures and gave the city manager tools. They've not been used yet. They were used briefly for Memorial Day weekend, but they've not been used for spring break.
Some of those include additional policing, for more officers on the street, more visible officers, those kinds of things.
Some of them included the opportunity for the city manager to roll back sidewalk cafes, lower music ambient measures, not have coolers on the beach, and not have all of these different things. Though there's 14 measures that they gave the city manager. It hasn't been tried yet. So those solutions were already sat down and talked about, put into place in anticipation of this year. The city commission several months ago very clearly gave a directive that the city needs to really focus on how to crowd manage the beach, how to separate this, how to create a flow. And those are and what came to the table was, let's close down liquor sales at 2 a.m., which one doesn't.
Where did that come from?
We don't really know. Because 88% of the calls to service are before 2 a.m. So, you know, the neighborhood associations also have come and stepped up and said, you know, our concern is that the entertainment district is going to be restricted and people are going to be looking into the residential neighborhoods, because nearby and walkable, Collins Park, West mm-hmm. Avenue, south of Fifth, there are clubs that are still going to be open till 5 a.m.
Mm-hmm. Ceci Velasco is our guest. She's the executive director of the Ocean Drive Association. It's a group of property and business owners working to improve the entertainment district in the Ocean Drive, South Beach area, talking about the potential of an earlier last call for alcohol over 17 days for spring break in South Beach. On South Beach, we did invite the mayor of Miami Beach, Dan Gelber, who supports the earlier last call for this short period of time. He did accept our original invitation, but then unfortunately something came up and the mayor was unable to join us. So, Ceci, as this moves forward, what is the potential result of a 17-day period with a 2 a.m. last call for alcohol on South Beach?
So there's been a couple of compromises, right? From the first reading, it had been changed to, and the commission agreed to, a 3 a.m. and less days. So it's less than 17 days. Our stand is, we're compromising again on a solution looking for a problem. So if after midnight, 1, 2, 3, 4, it doesn't matter. If that's not part of the solution, then why are we compromising on this? If any kind of a closure for any number of days is going to be brand damaging to our tourism and not really solving the problem, you're still going to have just as many cars coming over the causeway to get to the beach, right? Mm-hmm. So because they don't come, you know, for the clubs. But you are going to not allow the people who are going to book hotel rooms to be here and have that experience. In fact, you'll probably have more of those people that have already booked coming here in an exodus on Uber going over into the mainland. So I think, you know, you're causing more problems that are unintended consequences, and you're not laser focused on what can we do with crowd management? How can we do activations to get people a little bit more interested in other things and have a good experience while they're here?
Fort Lauderdale experienced a reputation regarding spring break for a number of years. And for many of those years, it was a generally decent reputation. And then, of course, that reputation went down pretty fast for Fort Lauderdale in the 1980s and early 1990s, probably not even that long, really. It was probably into the 1980s. And a number of measures were taken to crack down on the kind of behavior that the city was bothered by and felt was not the kind of image that the city wanted to portray to the rest of the vacationing world. Is there any risk of that in Miami Beach with spring break, the way that it has evolved, particularly on South Beach, regardless of when there's a last call for alcohol, the kinds of problems that you and the Ocean Drive Association has mm-hmm. identified and acknowledged that's out there. Whether or not it's inside the restaurants or not, it's there.
It's there, but it's also a little bit different than Fort Lauderdale or Panama City. Or Panama City lived off spring break. Fort Lauderdale lived on spring break. Miami Beach and Ocean Drive. This is Ocean Drive, Collins Avenue, Washington Avenue, right. Espanola Way. Yeah. So it's broader than even just the entertainment district. Ocean Drive in Miami Beach is a global name. We were just on the global stage for Super Bowl. It's stellar. It's different than Fort Lauderdale, the spring break area. We're not even a real spring break destination. In March, we have all kinds of tourists coming in. They come in annually. They come in from Europe. They come in from South America. We have a very solid tourism core of people that come here, and it's paired with this spring break organic kind of phenomenon, but we're not a spring break destination. So you can't, it can't be compared to Fort Lauderdale, but you can look at the economic damage that was done to Coconut Grove, Fort Lauderdale, Panama City. You have to be really careful with your tourism economy, because people save up and they can go anywhere.
Yeah, those dollars can move around pretty quickly. You have mm-hmm. to be careful with that image, right? Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, South Beach has multiple images. But one of those has been evolving when it comes to spring break, and certainly has gotten the attention of city commissioners mm-hmm. and the mayor through the years, not just this mayor, but previous mayor as well, to look at the kind of management of crowds mm-hmm. and also the ordinances and regulations governing some of that late night business.
I'm glad you bring up the past history, because in 2017, it was sent out to a referendum and it was overwhelmingly defeated by the residents. And the neighborhood associations are coming out right now saying, we already voted on this. We're not supporting this ordinance. They're encouraging the commissioners not to vote for the ordinance. The Fraternal Order of Police also are coming back saying there are other mechanisms to deal with this. This is not going to be the solution. We work really closely with the police department. I'm personally out there at 6 o'clock in the morning and helping them set up for the day. We have ongoing communications. It works. I get one call from the chief of police or any commander that's out there, and I immediately can tell every single manager of every single hotel and restaurant, we need to help the police by closing off checks, lowering music, whatever it is. But it's a minute-by-minute thing that we're working hand-in-hand with the police department, and we have been over the past few years. You can't codify that, and you can't legislate that. But certainly, we are getting more towards a solution.
We got one comment on Twitter from Alec, who is described as a Miami Beach resident, recent university graduate. He said that he does not think the ordinance will help public safety on the beach. The first reading of this ordinance was 5-2 in favor. Do you want to make any predictions about the Wednesday vote coming up next week if it comes to a vote?
We had 5 in favor. I know two commissioners very strongly saw clearly that this was not going to help the solution. Two of the newly elected commissioners were asking a lot of questions and did vote for it based on some compromises. But I think they're questioning whether or not this is the solution itself. I think that the mayor feels very strongly about this. I mean, we're partners with the mayor. In this particular instance, we think that this is not the solution, and we're on opposite ends. But we're not usually. We're usually right in line with what the mayor once. We just feel like the greater unintended consequences need to be determined, and we know that the commissioners are asking questions between first and second
reading. Am I going to get you to make a prediction about that vote on Wednesday?
No, I can't predict what the commissioners right. are going. I hope that they'll listen to the residents, because that I hope they'll listen to the electorate that voted over 64% not to do this last time. I think it's very clear in front of them now that we have data from the police department that 88% of the calls to service are prior to 2 a.m. I think it speaks very clearly, and I think the commissioners are asking those questions.
Ceci Velasco is the executive director of the Ocean Drive Association. We did invite the mayor of Miami Beach, Dan Gelber. He accepted that invitation, but unfortunately something came up at the last moment and he was unable to join us for this discussion. Ceci, we'll see you on Wednesday and have a great spring break in the meantime.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Appreciate your time. We got plenty more to come here on the South Florida Roundup. How South Florida election offices are preparing for the Florida primary coming up in just a matter of weeks. That's next as the Roundup continues. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Early voting in some parts of South Florida began in just over a week. Election officials working to ensure the votes get counted and counted on time. This certainly has some special resonance in Broward and Palm Beach counties, given recent experiences. They have complicated histories when it comes to elections, even dating back to the 2000 presidential election. Remember those butterfly ballot chads? Well, more recently, of course, in 2018, folks at those election offices were working some long hours to count and count again and count again those ballots in some very close races. Both Broward and Palm Beach counties have new supervisors of elections this year who are trying to improve the office's reputations and several years of elections mishaps. What are your questions about election procedure, voting procedures ahead of early voting opening up in just a few weeks' time for the March 17th presidential preference primary here in the state of Florida? 800-743-WLRN. That's our telephone number here on the South Florida Roundup. Maybe you have your mail-in ballot ready to go. What kind of questions do you have as you look at it? 800-743-9576. 800-743-9576. Peter Antonacci is along with us, the supervisor of elections for Broward County. Peter, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
So, you all prepared for the presidential primary in Broward County in the elections office?
We're in the middle of an election already, so we're beyond the preparation point. We're in the deployment point. So we mailed our first ballots on January 29th to our overseas voters who had requested vote by mail ballots. Mm-hmm. And the following week, we sent out about 145,000 domestic ballots. We've received about 38,000 of those ballots back, and it seems to me like people are pretty enthusiastic, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, have those 38,000 ballots you've received back, have those been opened and counted yet?
No, certainly not. All that has to wait for our canvassing board to meet, and they have their first meeting, their organizational meeting, on the 26th of February.
There have been obviously lots of questions still surrounding the security of election systems, and I want to ask you about that in a moment. But when it comes to counting those ballots on the evening of March 17th, what's going to be different this spring compared to election night on 2018 for Broward County?
It's a smaller election. Keep in mind that 715,000 people voted in November 2018. I expect we'll have a little more than half of that in March, because it is a pretty confined subject matter in
mm-hmm.
the election.
Yeah,
we have improved and expanded voting equipment. We have procedures that have been enhanced, and we really want to. It's a little bit like George Carlin used to say about mortal sin. You know, you got to want to commit mortal sin. We want to put on a good election this time, and we're motivated by interests in reputation and the like.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about that last point there, Peter. Are you presuming that the previous administration in the election supervisor's office wasn't interested in putting on a good election in Broward County?
No, that was not by way of contrast to her, but just as a general matter, if you want something badly enough, you tend to work harder for it. And I know the staff around this organization didn't like to be held up to a negative light 2 years ago, and they're determined to put a positive light on what we do around here.
Regarding election security, there still remains lots of questions about the security of election supervisors' offices and systems in Florida. We know from the Mueller report that at least two counties, had been hacked in 2016 by Russian hackers, fell victim to spear phishing or some kind of hacking. As you got into office there in the supervisor's office in Broward County, was Broward County one of those systems hacked by Russians in 2016?
It was not.
Was the system tested by Russian hackers in 2016?
I don't know what nationality they were. They could have been Moldavians or Bulgarians. I don't know. But the voter registration system is the system you're talking about, not the tabulation system.
That's correct, the voter registration system.
There are parties around the world, around the state, around Broward County every day that attempt to penetrate the system. And
are those ongoing currently?
Oh, absolutely. Attempts, of course, and the attempts are fended off, rejected. Most importantly, we know what happens every day because of our enhanced software situation, and we're in routine contact with law enforcement and with other supervisors and with Secretary of State, with Homeland Security, to make sure that our equipment is absolutely up to date. Our software is the best that can be purchased for the purposes of fending off, notifying and fending off attempts to penetrate the voter registration system.
Pete, hold the line here with us. Pete Antonacci is on the phone here on the South Florida Roundup, Supervisor of Elections for Broward County, talking about preparations and the deployment, as Peter said, regarding mail-in ballots already underway for the presidential preference primary. Dana Rivero is with us here at WLRN. We've seen similar questions here being asked about Palm Beach County because of recount issues that Palm Beach County also experienced in 2018. What do we know about the preparation about Palm Beach County, Danny?
So I did talk to the supervisor of elections there, Wendy Sartori-Link, and she had a kind of a list of things that she says that she'd started implementing since she was appointed into this office last year by Governor DeSantis. One of them is that she said her office is now on what's called the Albert system, which is basically in coordination with the Department of Homeland Security. And that's just, it's always running. It's just It's always monitoring for any hacking attempts and being in constant communication with her office and with many other offices around the state. Her office has also purchased new vote counting machines. This was the primary problem that office had in Palm Beach County in the 2018 recounts. They had the oldest machines in the state. It couldn't read more than one race at a time, so the machine started overmelting, and it became overheating.
Overheating,
and,
yeah,
and it became a very big issue. And they ultimately didn't meet some key deadlines. So they have new voting machines, and they also have a new alert system. If someone tries to vote more than once in one election, they get immediately notified. The supervisor there told me within 10 seconds that someone is attempting to vote twice. She said it's very rare, but it has happened. So they are immediately getting updates on that.
Pete, what kind of investments have been made, financial investments and training investments in the Broward office to prepare?
Well, in the last 18 months, we've invested about $2 million in equipment and software, both on the voter registration side, which is the security issues I was speaking about before,
right.
And on the tabulation side. We've also purchased some things in the world of voter election administration that people don't really know about. For example, we've purchased a system called Novus, which allows us to duplicate soiled and flawed ballots in front of the canvassing board.
How does that work?
Well, there's a million reasons why our machines will not read certain vote-by-mail ballots. I can't tell you how many vote-by-mail ballots we receive with coffee stains on them. people have them around their kitchen table.
Yeah. Understandable.
You get a little mustard on the ballot, and the machine says, hell no, I'm not reading this ballot. Something's wrong with it. And so out of fairness to the voter, the legislature has created a process where you examine that ballot in the presence of the canvassing board, determine where the votes are on that ballot, duplicate that ballot for the purposes of machine counting. I anticipate we'll have hundreds and hundreds of those coming up in the March election. And it's just not coffee stains and mustard. The machines, the high-speed counters are pretty sensitive. The machines will often not read certain ballots because the humidity is too high. There might be a little tiny cut in the paper.
Supervisor Antonacci, I have a question about the mail-in ballots. Even prior to when you arrived at the office, mail-in ballots in Broward County have been an ongoing issue for one reason or another. I'm just wondering, do you have any commentary on why you think that has been a reoccurring problem, and what has your office been doing to try to address those problems?
I'm not going to speak to the problems in the past. I will speak to the procedures that we've used in two municipal elections in 2019 to make sure the vote-by-mail ballots are handled properly. Keep in mind that voting by mail is an enormously popular feature of our system these days. In our March election in 2019, for the first time in Broward County, there were more vote-by-mail ballots than in-person ballots that were cast by voters. As I mentioned, we bought a system to help with our duplication process. We've purchased five additional high-speed counters. We've purchased a system that helps store these ballots in a more rational way, in a more secure way, while they're being queued up for counting and auditing. We've done quite a few things in that area, and it's cost a lot of money, $2 million altogether in the last 18 months.
Peter, hold on the line here. Peter Antonacci is along with us. He is the supervisor of elections in Broward County. Josephine is in Miramar on line two. Go ahead, Josephine. You are on the radio.
Yeah. Oh, my name is Josephine Graham. I live in Miramar, and I vote from my house because I cannot stand in line. I wear a pacemaker, although I still work. And I have not received anything for voting this year yet. And I intend to vote. I really intend to vote. So I want my voting papers.
So you're looking for your mail-in ballot, Josephine, is
yes,
that right?
Please.
That's
yes,
right. And did you file the proper request for that, Josephine?
I've always done that. I didn't know I had to refile.
Okay.
Nobody has said I am dead.
Pete Andonacci, help Josephine out there in Miramar. Pete, you still with us on the red line, Pete?
Yeah, I'm
there you
still
go.
Here.
Go ahead, sorry.
The request for vote-by-mail ballots is only valid for a two-year period. We have a lot of complaints from people who don't receive their ballots, and they don't realize that they have to renew their request. That would be my first answer. Mm-hmm. Please renew your request. If not, please email me at P. Antonacci, A-N-T-O-N-A-C-C-I, at BrowardSOE.org, and I'll make sure you get one.
Mr. Antonacci, finally, I want to ask you about the personal information that some of these mail-in ballots, I think all the mail-in ballots, are asking for, in addition to just the signature, which most people are used to. There's also fields to put in an email address and a phone number, and those are on the outside of these ballots. And that, of course, just raises concerns about, identity theft. Is that kind of personal information required for that mail-in ballot to be valid and to be counted?
No. Let me give you a little background on that. In 2019, the legislature was trying to solve a problem. And the problem that people perceived was either problems with mismatched signatures or problems with provisional ballots. And the supervisors informed the legislature that we don't have any way to get in touch with people if we received a flawed ballot of some kind. And so the legislature responded by adding these additional fields on the mail-in envelope. They are optional. For the August and November election, there's going to be a big disclaimer on the Broward ballot that says this stuff is optional.
Gotcha.
People don't like it for all the obvious reasons.
Yeah, right. Putting your cell phone number on the outside of that envelope can feel a little...
Right. It's just another example of trying to solve one problem creates another.
Pete Antonacci. Mr. Antonacci, thanks for joining us here on the South Florida Roundup. Appreciate it.
Have a good weekend.
Peter is the Broward County Elections Supervisor Chief there in Broward County. Danny Rivero, thanks, of course, for sharing your reporting with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, primary in the state of Florida, March 17th, and early voting does begin in just a few weeks. Finally on the roundup this week, Floridians vote in the presidential preference primary next month, and WLRN is asking you about what issues you care about most as Election Day approaches on March 17th.
What I'm concerned about is climate change, how Miami will be affected, what parts of Miami will be still here in a couple of years.
Jose Sebastian Ternus is a professor at Miami-Dade College. He says he thinks Senator Bernie Sanders stands out from the pack on environmental policy. Ternus teaches a writing class this semester focused on climate change. He says he wants his students to see how their lives could change in a future that's projected to be wetter and hotter.
One of our prompts is to imagine a special place in Miami that's culturally or historically significant to my students, and I asked them to write me a photo essay. So some students would write about a certain restaurant that they love, or maybe their abuelo's house, or a certain domino area, domino park. You could really get a sense of what my students are worried about, that they want to preserve, that they want their children to see.
So we want to hear from you. What are you worried about? What are you optimistic about in the 2020 election? What issues are top of mind as you consider voting in the Florida presidential primary later on next month? You can visit WLRN.org. Follow us on social media at WLRN. Look for us on Facebook and on Instagram. Early voting begins March 2nd in Miami-Dade and Monroe counties, March 7th in Broward and Palm Beach counties. And that'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Mertz. WLRN's director of radio programming is Jason Zabka. And the show's technical supervisor is Richard Ives. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting public radio. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.